In the front door as a mysterious portal of the Temple of State, whose solemn opening was attended with a sacrifice of roast fowls. I had believed in the kitchen as a chaste, though not magnificent, apartment. I had believed in the forge as the glowing road to manhood and independence. Within a single year, all this was changed. Now, it was all coarse and common, and I would not have had Miss Havisham and Estella see it on any account. How much of my ungracious condition of mind may have been my own fault, how much Miss Havisham's, how much my sister's, is now of no moment to me or to anyone. The change was made in me. The thing was done. Well or ill done, excusably or inexcusably, it was done. Once it had seemed to me that when I should at last roll up my shirt sleeves and go into the forge, Joe's prentice, I should be distinguished and happy. Now the reality was in my hold. I only felt that I was dusty with the dust of small coal, and that had a weight upon my daily remembrance to which the anvil was a feather. There have been occasions in my later life, I suppose as in most lives, when I have felt for a time as if a thick curtain had fallen on all its interest and romance, to shut me out from anything save dull endurance any more. Never has that curtain dropped so heavy and blank as when my way in life lay stretched out straight before me through the newly entered road of apprenticeship to Joe. I remember that at a later period of my time, I used to stand about the churchyard on Sunday evenings when night was falling, comparing my own perspective with the windy marsh view, and making out some dark likeness between them by thinking how flat and low both were, and how on both there came an unknown way and a dark mist, and then the sea. I was quite as dejected on the first working day of my apprenticeship as in that aftertime, but I am glad to know that I never breathed a murmur to Joe while my indentures lasted. It is about the only thing I am glad to know of myself in that connection. For though it includes what I proceed to add, all the merit of what I proceed to add was Joe's. It was not because I was faithful, but because Joe was faithful, that I never ran away and went for a soldier or a sailor. It was not because I had a strong sense of the virtue of industry, but because Joe had a strong sense of the virtue of industry, that I worked with tolerable zeal against the grain. It is not possible to know how far the influence of any amiable, honest-hearted, duty-doing man flies out into the world, but it is very possible to know how it has touched oneself in going by. And I know right well that any good that intermixed itself with my apprenticeship came of plain, contented Joe, and not of restless, aspiring, discontented me. What I wanted, who can say? How can I say when I never knew? What I dreaded was that in some unlucky hour, I, being at my grimiest and commonest, should lift up my eyes and see Estella looking in at one of the wooden windows of the forge. I was haunted by the fear that she would, sooner or later, find me out with a black face and hands doing the coarsest part of my work, and would exult over me and despise me. Often after dark, when I was pulling the bellows for Joe, and we were singing Old Clem, and when the thought how we used to sing it at Miss Havisham's would seem to show me Estella's face in the fire, with her pretty hair fluttering in the wind, and her eyes scorning me. Often at such a time I would look towards those panels of black night in the wall which the wooden windows then were, and would fancy that I saw her, just drawing her face away, and would believe that she had come at last. After that, when we went into supper, the place and the meal would have a more homely look than ever, and I would feel more ashamed of home than ever in my own ungracious breast. Chapter 15. As I was getting too big for Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt's room, my education under that preposterous female terminated. Not, however, until Biddy had imparted everything she knew, from the little catalogue of prices to a comic song she had once bought for a halfpenny, although the only coherent part of the latter piece of literature were the opening lines. When I went to Lunnon town, sirs, to rule the rule, to rule the rule, wasn't I done very brown, sirs, to rule the rule, to rule the rule. Still, in my desire to be wiser, I got this composition by heart with the utmost gravity. Nor do I recollect that I questioned its merit, except that I thought, as I still do, the amount of two rule somewhat in excess of the poetry. In my hunger for information, I made proposals to Mr. Wopsle to bestow some intellectual crumbs upon me, with which he kindly complied. As it turned out, however, that he only wanted me for a dramatic lay figure, to be contradicted and embraced and wept over and bullied and clutched and stabbed and knocked about in a variety of ways, I soon declined that course of instruction, though not until Mr. Wopsle, in his poetic fury, had severely mauled me. Whatever I acquired, I tried to impart to Joe. This statement sounds so well that I cannot in my conscience let it pass unexplained. I wanted to make Joe less ignorant and common, that he might be worthier of my society, and less open to Estella's reproach. The old battery out on the marshes was our place of study, and a broken slate and a short piece of slate pencil were our educational implements, to which Joe always added a pipe of tobacco. I never knew Joe to remember anything from one Sunday to another, or to acquire under my tuition any piece of information whatever. Yet he would smoke his pipe at the battery with a far more sagacious air than anywhere else, even with a learned air, as if he considered himself to be advancing immensely. Dear fellow, I hope he did. It was pleasant and quiet out there, with the sails on the river passing beyond the earthwork, and sometimes, when the tide was low, looking as if they belonged to sunken ships that were still sailing on at the bottom of the water. Whenever I watched the vessels standing out to sea with their white sails spread, I somehow thought of Miss Havisham and Estella. And whenever the light struck aslant, far off, upon a cloud or sail, or green hillside or waterline, it was just the same. Miss Havisham and Estella and the strange house and the strange life appeared to have something to do with everything that was picturesque. One Sunday with Joe, greatly enjoying his pipe, had so plumed himself on being most awful dull that I had given him up for the day. I lay on the earthwork for some time with my chin on my hand, descrying traces of Miss Havisham and Estella all over the prospect, in the sky and in the water, until at last I resolved to mention a thought concerning them that had been much in my head. "Joe," said I, "don't you think I ought to make Miss Havisham a visit?"
"Well, Pip," returned Joe, slowly considering, "what for?"
"What for, Joe? What is any visit made for?"
"Well, there is some wizards, perhaps," said Joe, "as forever remains open to the question, Pip. But in regard of wizarding Miss Havisham, she might think you wanted something, expected something of her."
"Don't you think I might say that I did not, Joe?"
"You might, old chap," said Joe, "and she might credit it. Similarly, she mightn't."
Joe felt as I did, that he had made a point there, and he pulled hard at his pipe to keep himself from weakening it by repetition.
"You see, Pip," Joe pursued as soon as he was past that danger, "Miss Havisham done the handsome thing by you. When Miss Havisham done the handsome thing by you, she called me back to say to me, as that were all."
"Yes, Joe, I heard her."
"All," Joe repeated, very emphatically.
"Yes, Joe, I tell you I heard her.
Which I mean to say, Pip, it might be that her meaning were, make an end on it, as you was, me to the north, and you to the south, keep in sunders."
I had thought of that too, and it was very far from comforting to me to find that he had thought of it, for it seemed to render it more probable. "But, Joe..."
"Yes, old chap?"
"Here I am, getting on in the first year of my time, and since the day of my being bound, I have never thanked Miss Havisham, or asked after her, or shown that I remember her."
"That's true, Pip, and unless you was to turn her out a set of shoes all four round, and which I mean to say as even a set of shoes all four round might not act acceptable as a present in the total vacancy of hooves."
I don't mean that sort of remembrance, Joe. I don't mean a present." But Joe had got the idea of a present in his head, and must harp upon it.
"Or even," said he, "if you was helped to knocking her up a new chain for the front door, or say a gross or two of shark-headed screws for general use, or some light fancy article, such as a toasting fork when she took her muffins, or a gridiron when she took a sprat or such like.
"I don't mean any present at all, Joe," I interposed.
"Well," said Joe, still harping on it as though I had particularly pressed it, "if it was yourself, Pep, I wouldn't. No, I would not. For what's a door chain when she's got one always up, and shark-headers as open to misrepresentations? And if it was a toasting fork, you'd go into brass and do yourself no credit. And the uncommonest workman can't show himself uncommon in a gridiron, for a gridiron is a gridiron," said Joe, steadfastly impressing it upon me as if he were endeavouring to arouse me from a fixed delusion. "And you may aim at what you like, but a gridiron will come out either by your leave or again your leave. And you can't help yourself."
"My dear Joe," I cried in desperation, taking hold of his coat, "don't go on in that way. I never thought of making Miss Havisham any present."
"No, Pip," Joe assented, as if he had been contending for that all along. "And what I say to you is, you're right, Pip."
"Yes, Joe. But what I wanted to say was that as we're rather slack just now, if you would give me a half-holiday tomorrow, I think I would go uptown and make a call on Miss Havisham."
"Which her name," said Joe gravely, "ain't Est Havisham, Pip, unless she been rechristened."
"I know, Joe, I know. It was a slip of mine. What do you think of it, Joe?"
In brief, Joe thought that if I thought well of it, he thought well of it. But he was particular in stipulating that if I were not received with cordiality, or if I were not encouraged to repeat my visit as a visit which had no ulterior object, but was simply one of gratitude for a favour received, then this experimental trip should have no successor. By these conditions, I promised to abide. Now Joe kept a journeyman at weekly wages, whose name was Orlick. He pretended that his Christian name was Dolge, a clear impossibility, but he was a fellow of that obstinate disposition that I believe him to have been the prey of no delusion in this particular, but wilfully to have imposed that name upon the village as an affront to its understanding. He was a broad-shouldered, loose-limbed, swarthy fellow of great strength, never in a hurry and always slouching. He never even seemed to come to his work on purpose, but would slouch in as if by mere accident, and when he went to the Jolly Bargeman to eat his dinner, or went away at night, he would slouch out, like Cain or the Wandering Jew, as if he had no idea where he was going and no intention of ever coming back. He lodged at a sluice-keeper's out on the marshes, and on working days would come slouching from his hermitage, with his hands in his pockets and his dinner loosely tied in a bundle round his neck and dangling on his back. On Sundays he mostly lay all day on sluice-gates or stood against ricks and barns. He always slouched, locomotively, with his eyes on the ground, and when accosted or otherwise required to raise them, he looked up in a half-resentful, half-puzzled way, as though the only thought he ever had was that it was rather an odd and injurious fact that he should never be thinking. This morose journeyman had no liking for me. When I was very small and timid, he gave me to understand that the devil lived in a black corner of the forge, and that he knew the fiend very well. Also, that it was necessary to make up the fire once in 7 years with a live boy, and that I might consider myself fuel. When I became Joe's prentice, Orlick was perhaps confirmed by some suspicion that I should displace him, albeit he liked me still less. Not that he ever said anything or did anything, openly importing hostility. I only noticed that he always beat his sparks in my direction, and that whenever I sang Old Clem, he came in out of time. Dolge Orlick was at work and present next day when I reminded Joe of my half-holiday. He said nothing at the moment, for he and Joe had just got a piece of hot iron between them, and I was at the bellows. But by and by he said, leaning on his hammer,
"Now, master, sure you're not going to favour only one of us. If young Pip has a half-holiday, do as much for old Orlick."
I suppose he was about 25, but he usually spoke of himself as an ancient person.
"Why, what'll you'll do with a half-holiday if you get it?" said Joe. "What I'll do with it? What he'll do with it? I'll do as much with it as him, said Orlick.
Aster Pep, he's going uptown, said Joe.
Well then, as to old Orlick, he's a-going uptown, retorted that worthy. Two can go uptown. Tain't only one what can go uptown.
Don't lose your temper, said Joe.
Shall if I like, growled Orlick. Somewhere near uptowning. Now, master, come. No favouring in this shop. Be a man.
The master, refusing to entertain the subject until the journeyman was in a better temper, Orlick plunged at the furnace, drew out a red-hot bar, made at me with it, as if he were going to run it through my body, whisked it round my head, laid it on the anvil, hammered it out, as if it were I thought, and the sparks were my spurting blood, and finally said when he had hammered himself hot and the iron cold, and he again leaned on his hammer,
"Now, master?"
"Are you all right now?" demanded Joe.
"Ah, I'm all right," said gruff old Orlick.
"Then, as in general, you stick to your work as well as most men," said Joe. "Let it be a half-holiday for all."
My sister had been standing silent in the yard within hearing. She was a most unscrupulous spy and listener, and she instantly looked in at one of the windows.
"Like you, you fool," she said to Joe, "giving holidays to great idle hulkers like that. You're a rich man, upon my life, to waste wages in that way. I wish I was his master."
"You'd be everybody's master if you durst," retorted Orlick with an ill-favoured grin.
"Let her alone," said Joe.
"I'll be a match for all noodles and all rogues," returned my sister, beginning to work herself into a mighty rage. "And I couldn't be a match for the noodles without being a match for your master, who's the dunder-headed king of the noodles. And I couldn't be a match for the rogues without being a match for you, who are the blackest-looking and the worst rogue between this and France. Now."
"You're a foul shrew, Mother Gargery," growled the journeyman. "If that makes a judge of rogues, you ought to be a good'un."
"Let her alone, will you?" said Joe.
"What did you say?" cried my sister, beginning to scream. "What did you say? What did that fellow Orlick say to me, Pip? What did he call me, with my husband standing by? Oh, oh!"
Each of these exclamations was a shriek, and I must remark of my sister what is equally true of all the violent women I have ever seen. The passion was no excuse for her, because it is undeniable that instead of lapsing into passion, she consciously and deliberately took extraordinary pains to force herself into it, and became blindly furious by regular stages.
"What was the name that he gave me before the base man who swore to defend me? Oh, hold me! Oh!"
"Ah," growled the journeyman between his teeth. "I'd hold you, if you was my wife. I'd hold you under the pump and choke it out of you. I tell you, let her alone," said Joe.
"Oh, to hear him,"
cried my sister, with a clap of her hands and a scream together, which was her next stage.
"To hear the names he's giving me. That Orlick in my own house, me, a married woman, with my husband standing by. Oh, oh!"
Here my sister, after a fit of clappings and screamings, beat her hands upon her bosom and upon her knees, and threw her cap off and pulled her hair down, which were the last stages on her road to frenzy. Being by this time a perfect fury and a complete success, she made a dash at the door, which I had fortunately locked. What could the wretched Joe do now, after his disregarded parenthetical interruptions, but stand up to his journeyman and ask him what he meant by interfering betwixt himself and Mrs. Joe, and further, whether he was man enough to come on? Old Orlick felt that the situation admitted of nothing less than coming on, and was on his defence straight away. So, without so much as a pulling off their singed and burnt aprons, they went at one another like two giants. But if any man in that neighbourhood could stand up long against Joe, I never saw the man. Orlick, as if he had been of no more account than the pale young gentleman, was very soon among the coal dust, and in no hurry to come out of it. Then Joe unlocked the door, and picked up my sister, who had dropped insensible at the window, but who had seen the fight first, I think, and who was carried into the house and laid down, and who was recommended to revive, and would do nothing but struggle and clench her hands in Joe's hair. Then came that singular calm and silence which succeeded all uproars. And then, with the vague sensation which I have always connected with such a lull, namely, that it was Sunday and somebody was dead, I went upstairs to dress myself. When I came down again, I found Joe and Orlick sweeping up, without any other traces of discomposure than a slit on the end of Orlick's nostrils, which was neither repressive nor ornamental. A pot of beer had appeared from the Jolly Bargeman, and they were sharing it by turns in a peaceable manner. The lull had a sedative and philosophical influence on Joe, who followed me out into the road to say, as a parting observation that might do me good,
"On the rampage, Pep, and off the rampage, Pep. Such is life."
With what absurd emotions, for we think the feelings that are very serious in a man quite comical in a boy, I found myself again going to Miss Havisham's, matters little here, nor how I passed and repassed the gate many times before I could make up my mind to ring, nor how I debated whether I should go away without ringing, nor how I should undoubtedly have gone if my time had been my own to come back. Miss Sarah Pocket came to the gate. No Estella.
"How, then? You here again?"
said Miss Pocket.
"What do you want?"
When I said that I only came to see how Miss Havisham was, Sarah evidently deliberated whether or no she should send me about my business. But unwilling to hazard the responsibility, she let me in and presently brought the sharp message that I was
to come up.
Everything was unchanged, and Miss Havisham was alone.
"Well," said she, fixing her eyes upon me, "I hope you want nothing. You'll get nothing."
"No, indeed, Miss Havisham. I only wanted you to know that I'm doing very well in my apprenticeship, and am always much obliged to you."
"There, there," with the old restless fingers. "Come now and then. Come on your birthday. Aye,"
she cried, suddenly turning herself and her chair towards me.
"You are looking round for Estella, eh?"
I had been looking round, in fact, for Estella, and I stammered that I hoped she was well.
"Abroad," said Miss Havisham, "educating for a lady, far out of reach, prettier than ever, admired by all who see her. Do you feel that you have lost her?"
There was such a malignant enjoyment in her utterance of the last words, and she broke into such a disagreeable laugh, that I was at a loss what to say. She spared me the trouble of considering by dismissing me. When the gate was closed upon me by Sarah of the walnut-shell countenance, I felt more than ever dissatisfied with my home and with my trade and with everything, and that was all I took by that motion. As I was loitering along the high street, looking in disconsolately at the shop windows and thinking what I would buy if I were a gentleman, who should come out of the bookshop but Mr. Wopsle? Mr. Wopsle had in his hand the affecting tragedy of George Barnwell, in which he had that moment invested sixpence, with the view of heaping every word of it on the head of Pumblechook, with whom he was going to drink tea. No sooner did he see me than he appeared to consider that a special providence had put a prentice in his way to read at, and he laid hold of me and insisted on my accompanying him to the Pumblechookian parlour. As I knew it would be miserable at home, and as the nights were dark and the way was dreary, and almost any companionship on the road was better than none, I made no great resistance. Consequently, we turned into Pumblechook's just as the street and shops were lighting up. As I never assisted at any other representation of George Barnwell, I don't know how long it may usually take, but I know very well that it took until 9:30 that night, and that when Mr. Wopsle got into Newgate, I thought he never would go to the scaffold. He became so much slower than at any former period of his disgraceful career. I thought it a little too much that he should complain of being cut short in his flower after all, as if he'd not been running to seed, leaf after leaf, ever since his course began. This, however, was a mere question of length and wearisomeness. What stung me was the identification of the whole affair with my unoffending self. When Barnwell began to go wrong, I declare I felt positively apologetic. Pumblechook's indignant stare so taxed me with it. Wopsle, too, took pains to present me in the worst light. At once ferocious and maudlin, I was made to murder my uncle with no extenuating circumstances whatever. Millwood put me down in argument on every occasion. It became sheer monomania in my master's daughter to care a button for me, and all I can say for my gasping and procrastinating conduct on the fatal morning is that it was worthy of the general feebleness of my character. Even after I was happily hanged and Wopsle had closed the book,
Pumblechook sat staring at me and shaking his head and saying, "Take warning, boy, take warning," as if it were a well-known fact that I contemplated murdering a near relation, provided I could only induce one to have the weakness to become my benefactor. It was a very dark night when it was all over, and when I set out with Mr. Wopsle on the walk home. Beyond town, we found a heavy mist out, and it fell wet and thick. The turnpike lamp was a blur, quite out of the lamp's usual place, apparently, and its rays looked solid substance on the fog. We were noticing this, and saying how that the mist rose with a change of wind from a certain quarter of our marshes, when we came upon a man slouching under the lee of the turnpike house. "Hello," we said, stopping. "Orlick there?"
"Ah," he answered, slouching out. "I was standing by a minute on the chance of company."
"You are late," I remarked. Orlick not unnaturally answered, "Well, and you're late."
"We have been," said Mr. Wopsle, exalted with his late performance. "We have been indulging, Mr. Orlick, in an intellectual evening."
Old Orlick growled as if he had nothing to say about that, and we all went on together. I asked him presently whether he'd been spending his half-holiday up and down town.
"Yes," said he, "all of it. I come in behind yourself. I didn't see you, but I must have been pretty close behind you. By the by, the guns is going again."
"Of the hulks," said I.
"Aye, there's some of the birds flown from the cages. The guns have been going since dark about. You'll hear one presently."
In effect, we had not walked many yards further when the well-remembered boom came towards us, deadened by the mist, and heavily rolled away along the low grounds by the river, as if it were pursuing and threatening the fugitives.
"A good night for cutting off in," said Orlick. "We'd be puzzled how to bring down a jailbird on the wing tonight."
The subject was a suggestive one to me, and I thought about it in silence. Mr. Wopsle, as the ill-requited uncle of the evening's tragedy, fell to meditating aloud in his garden at Camberwell. Orlick, with his hands in his pockets, slouched heavily at my side. It was very dark, very wet, very muddy, and so we splashed along. Now and then the sound of the signal cannon broke upon us again, and again rolled sulkily along the course of the river. I kept myself to myself and my thoughts. Mr. Wopsle died amiably at Camberwell, and exceedingly game on Bosworth Field, and in the greatest agonies at Glastonbury. Orlick sometimes growled,
beat it out, old Clem, with a clink for the stout, old Clem."
I thought he'd been drinking, but he was not drunk. Thus we came to the village. The way by which we approached it took us past the Three Jolly Bargemen, which we were surprised to find, it being 11 o'clock, in a state of commotion, with the door wide open and unwanted lights that had been hastily caught up and put down scattered about. Mr. Wopsle dropped in to ask what was the matter, surmising that a convict had been taken, but came running out in a great hurry.
"There's something wrong," said he without stopping. "Up at your place, Pip. Run, all."
"What is it?" I asked, keeping up with him. So did Orlick at my side.
"I can't quite understand. The house seems to have been violently entered when Joe Gargery was out, supposed by convicts. Somebody has been attacked and hurt."
We were running too fast to admit of more being said, and we made no stop until we got into our kitchen. It was full of people. The whole village was there, or in the yard. And there was a surgeon, and there was Joe, and there were a group of women, all on the floor in the midst of the kitchen. The unemployed bystanders drew back when they saw me, and so I became aware of my sister, lying without any sense or movement on the bare boards where she had been knocked down by a tremendous blow on the back of the head, dealt by some unknown hand when her face was turned towards the fire, destined never to be on the rampage again while she was the wife of Joe.
Chapter 16. With my head full of George Barnwell, I was at first disposed to believe that I must have had some hand in the attack upon my sister, or at all events that as her near relation, popularly known to be under obligations to her, I was a more legitimate object of suspicion than anyone else. But when, in the clearer light of next morning, I began to reconsider the matter and to hear it discussed around me on all sides, I took another view of the case, which was more reasonable. Joe had been in the Three Jolly Bargemen, smoking his pipe, from a quarter after 8 o'clock to a quarter before 10. While he was there, my sister had been seen standing at the kitchen door and had exchanged good night with a farm labourer going home. The man could not be more particular as to the time at which he saw her, he got into dense confusion when he tried to be, than that it must have been before 9. When Joe went home at 10:05, he found her struck down on the floor and promptly called in assistance. The fire had not then burnt unusually low, nor was the snuff of the candle very long. The candle, however, had been blown out. Nothing had been taken away from any part of the house, neither, beyond the blowing out of the candle, which stood on a table between the door and my sister, and was behind her when she stood facing the fire and was struck, was there any disarrangement of the kitchen, excepting such as she herself had made in falling and bleeding. But there was one remarkable piece of evidence on the spot. She had been struck with something blunt and heavy on the head and spine. After the blows were dealt, something heavy had been thrown down at her with considerable violence as she lay on her face, and on the ground beside her, when Joe picked her up, was a convict's leg iron, which had been filed asunder. Now Joe, examining this iron with the smith's eye, declared it to have been filed asunder some time ago. The hue and cry going off to the hulks, and people coming thence to examine the iron, Joe's opinion was corroborated. They did not undertake to say when it had left the prison ships to which it undoubtedly had once belonged, but they claimed to know for certain that that particular manacle had not been worn by either of the two convicts who had escaped last night. Further, one of those two was already retaken and had not freed himself of his iron. Knowing what I knew, I set up an inference of my own here. I believe the iron to be my convict's iron, the iron I had seen and heard him filing at on the marshes. But my mind did not accuse him of having put it to its latest use, for I believed one of two other persons to have become possessed of it, and to have turned it to this cruel account. Either Orlick, or the strange man who had shown me the file. Now, as to Orlick, he had gone to town exactly as he told us when we picked him up at the turnpike. He had been seen about town all the evening. He had been in divers companies in several public houses, and he had come back with myself and Mr. Wopsle. There was nothing against him, save the quarrel, and my sister had quarrelled with him and with everybody else about her 10,000 times. As to the strange man, if he had come back for his 2 banknotes, there could have been no dispute about them, because my sister was fully prepared to restore them. Besides, there had been no altercation. The assailant had come in so silently and suddenly that she had been felled before she could look round. It was horrible to think that I had provided the weapon, however undesignedly, but I could hardly think otherwise. I suffered unspeakable trouble while I considered and reconsidered whether I should at last dissolve that spell of my childhood and tell Joe all the story. For months afterwards, I every day settled the question finally in the negative, and reopened and re-argued it next morning. The contention came, after all, to this. The secret was such an old one now, had so grown into me and become part of myself that I could not tear it away. In addition to the dread that having led up to so much mischief it would now be more likely than ever to alienate Joe from me if he believed it, I had the further restraining dread that he would not believe it, but would assert it with the fabulous dogs and veal cutlets as a monstrous invention. However, I temporized with myself, of course, for was I not wavering between right and wrong when the thing is always done, and resolved to make a full disclosure if I should see any such new occasion as a new chance of helping in the discovery of the assailant. The constables and Bow Street men from London, for this happened in the days of the extinct red-waistcoated police, were about the house for a week or two, and did pretty much what I have heard and read of like authorities doing in other such cases. They took up several obviously wrong people, and they ran their heads very hard against wrong ideas, and persisted in trying to fit the circumstances to the ideas instead of trying to extract ideas from the circumstances. Also, They stood about the door of the Jolly Bargemen, with knowing and reserved looks that filled the whole neighbourhood with admiration, and they had a mysterious manner of taking their drink that was almost as good as taking the culprit, but not quite, for they never did it. Long after these constitutional powers had dispersed, my sister lay very ill in bed. Her sight was disturbed, so that she saw objects multiplied, and grasped at visionary teacups and wine glasses instead of the realities. Her hearing was greatly impaired, her memory also, and her speech was unintelligible. When at last she came round so far as to be helped downstairs, it was still necessary to keep my slate always by her, that she might indicate in writing what she could not indicate in speech. As she was, very bad handwriting apart, a more than indifferent speller, and as Joe was a more than indifferent reader, extraordinary complications arose between them, which I was always called in to solve. The administration of mutton instead of medicine, the substitution of tea for Joe and the baker for bacon, were among the mildest of my own mistakes. However, her temper was greatly improved, and she was patient. A tremulous uncertainty of the action of all her limbs soon became a part of her regular state, and afterwards, at intervals of 2 or 3 months, she would often put her hands to her head, and would then remain for about a week at a time in some gloomy aberration of mind. We were at a loss to find a suitable attendant for her, until a circumstance happened conveniently to relieve us. Mr. Wopsle's great aunt conquered a confirmed habit of living into which she had fallen, and Biddy became a part of our establishment. It may have been about a month after my sister's reappearance in the kitchen, when Biddy came to us with a small speckled box containing the whole of her worldly effects, and became a blessing to the household. Above all, she was a blessing to Joe, for the dear old fellow was sadly cut up by the constant contemplation of the wreck of his wife, and had been accustomed, while attending on her of an evening, to turn to me every now and then and say, with his blue eyes moistened, "Such a fine figure of a woman as she once were, Pip." Biddy, instantly taking the cleverest charge of her, as though she had studied her from infancy, Joe became able, in some sort, to appreciate the greater quiet of his life, and to get down to the Jolly Bargemen now and then for a change that did him good. It was characteristic of the police people that they had all more or less suspected poor Joe, though he never knew it, and that they had to a man concurred in regarding him as one of the deepest spirits they had ever encountered. Biddy's first triumph in her new office was to solve a difficulty that had completely vanquished me. I had tried hard at it, but had made nothing of it. Thus it was, again and again and again, my sister had traced upon the slate a character that looked like a curious T, and then with the utmost eagerness had called our attention to it as something she particularly wanted. I had in vain tried everything producible that began with a T, from tar to toast and tub. At length it had come into my head that the sign looked like a hammer, and on my lustily calling the word in my sister's ear, she had begun to hammer on the table and had expressed a qualified assent. Thereupon I had brought in all our hammers, one after another, but without avail. Then I bethought me of a crutch, the shape being much the same, and I borrowed one in the village and displayed it to my sister with considerable confidence. But she shook her head to that extent when she was shown it that we were terrified lest, in her weak and shattered state, she should dislocate her neck. When my sister found that Biddy was very quick to understand her, this mysterious sign reappeared on the slate. Biddy looked thoughtfully at it, heard my explanation, looked thoughtfully at my sister, looked thoughtfully at Joe, who was always represented on the slate by his initial letter, and ran into the forge, followed by Joe and me.
"Why, of course!" cried Biddy with an exultant face. "Don't you see? It's him!"
Orlick, without a doubt. She had lost his name and could only signify him by his hammer. We told him why we wanted him to come into the kitchen, and he slowly laid down his hammer, wiped his brow with his arm, took another wipe at it with his apron, and came slouching out, with a curious loose vagabond bend in the knees that strongly distinguished him. I confessed that I expected to see my sister denounce him, and that I was disappointed by the different result. She manifested the greatest anxiety to be on good terms with him, was evidently much pleased by his being at length produced, and motioned that she would have him given something to drink. She watched his countenance as if she were particularly wishful to be assured that he took kindly to his reception. She showed every possible desire to conciliate him, and there was an air of humble propitiation in all she did, such as I have seen pervade the bearing of a child towards a hard master. After that day, a day rarely passed without her drawing the hammer on her slate, and without Orlick slouching in and standing doggedly before her, as if he knew no more than I did what to make of it. Chapter 17. I now fell into a regular routine of apprenticeship life, which was varied, beyond the limits of the village and the marshes, by no more remarkable circumstance than the arrival of my birthday and my paying another visit to Miss Havisham. I found Miss Sarah Pocket still on duty at the gate. I found Miss Havisham just as I had left her, and she spoke of Estella in the very same way, if not in the very same words. The interview lasted but a few minutes, and she gave me a guinea when I was going, and told me to come again on my next birthday. I may mention at once that this became an annual custom. I tried to decline taking the guinea on the first occasion, but with no better effect than causing her to ask me very angrily if I expected more. Then, and after that, I took it. So unchanging was the dull old house, the yellow light in the darkened room, the faded spectre in the chair by the dressing-table glass, that I felt as if the stopping of the clocks had stopped time in that mysterious place, and while I and everything else outside it grew older, it stood still. Daylight never entered the house as to my thoughts and remembrances of it, any more than as to the actual fact. It bewildered me, and under its influence I continued at heart to hate my trade and to be ashamed of home. Imperceptibly, I became conscious of a change in Biddy, however. Her shoes came up at the heel. Her hair grew bright and neat. Her hands were always clean. She was not beautiful. She was common, and could not be like Estella. But she was pleasant and wholesome and sweet-tempered. She had not been with us more than a year. I remember her being newly out of mourning at the time it struck me. When I observed myself one evening that she had curiously thoughtful and attentive eyes, eyes that were very pretty and very good. It came of my lifting up my own eyes from a task I was poring at, writing some passages from a book to improve myself in two ways at once by a sort of stratagem, and seeing Biddy observant of what I was about. I laid down my pen, and Biddy stopped in her needlework without laying it down. "Biddy," said I, "how do you manage it? Either I am very stupid, or you are very clever." "What is it that I manage? I don't know," returned Biddy, smiling. She managed our whole domestic life, and wonderfully too. But I didn't mean that, though that made what I did mean more surprising. "How do you manage, Biddy," said I, "to learn everything that I learn, and always to keep up with me?" I was beginning to be rather vain of my knowledge, for I spent my birthday guinea on it, and set aside the greater part of my pocket money for similar investment, though I have no doubt now that the little I knew was extremely dear at the price.
"I might as well ask you," said Biddy, "how you manage."
"No, because when I come in from the forge of a night, anyone can see me turning to at it. But you never turn to at it, Biddy."
"I suppose I must catch it, like a cough,"
said Biddy quietly, and went on with her sewing. Pursuing my idea as I leaned back in my wooden chair and looked at Biddy sewing away with her head on one side, I began to think her rather an extraordinary girl, for I called to mind now that she was equally accomplished in the terms of our trade, and the names of our different sorts of work, and our various tools. In short, whatever I knew, Biddy knew. Theoretically, she was already as good a blacksmith as I, or better. "You are one of those, Biddy," said I, "who make the most of every chance. You never had a chance before you came here, and see how improved you are." Biddy looked at me for an instant, and went on with her sewing.
I was your first teacher, though, wasn't I? Said she as she sewed.
Biddy,
I exclaimed in amazement.
Why, you're crying.
No, I'm not, said Biddy, looking up and laughing.
What put that in your head?
What could have put it in my head but the glistening of a tear as it dropped on her work? I sat silent, recalling what a drudge she had been until Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt successfully overcame that bad habit of living, so highly desirable to be got rid of by some people. I recalled the hopeless circumstances by which she had been surrounded in the miserable little shop and the miserable little noisy evening school with that miserable old bundle of incompetence always to be dragged and shouldered. I reflected that even in those untoward times there must have been latent in Biddy what was now developing, for in my first uneasiness and discontent I had turned to her for help as a matter of course. Biddy sat quietly sewing, shedding no more tears, and while I looked at her and thought about it all, it occurred to me that perhaps I had not been sufficiently grateful to Biddy. I might have been too reserved and should have patronized her more, though I did not use that precise word in my meditations, with my confidence. Yes, Biddy, I observed when I had done turning it over. You were my first teacher, and that at a time when we little thought of ever being together like this in this kitchen.
Ah, poor thing, replied Biddy.
It was like her self-forgetfulness to transfer the remark to my sister, and to get up and be busy about her, making her more comfortable.
That's sadly true.
Well, said I, we must talk together a little more, as we used to do, and I must consult you a little more, as I used to do. Let us have a quiet walk on the marshes next Sunday, Biddy, and a long chat. My sister was never left alone now, but Jo more than readily undertook the care of her on that Sunday afternoon, and Biddy and I went out together. It was summertime and lovely weather. When we had passed the village and the church and the churchyard, and were out on the marshes, and began to see the sails of the ships as they sailed on, I began to combine Miss Havisham and Estella with the prospect in my usual way. When we came to the riverside and sat down on the bank, with the water rippling at our feet, making it all more quiet than it would have been without that sound, I resolved that it was a good time and place for the admission of Biddy into my inner confidence.
"Biddy,"
said I, after binding her to secrecy, "I want to be a gentleman."
"Oh, I wouldn't if I was you," she returned. "I don't think it would answer."
"Biddy," said I with some severity, "I have particular reasons for wanting to be a gentleman."
"You know best, Pip, but don't you think you're happier as you are?"
"Biddy," I exclaimed impatiently, "I am not at all happy as I am. I'm disgusted with my calling and with my life. I have never taken to either since I was bound. Don't be absurd."
"Was I absurd?"
said Biddy, quietly raising her eyebrows.
"I'm sorry for that. I didn't mean to be. I only want you to do well and be comfortable."
"Well, then, understand once for all that I never shall or can be comfortable, or anything but miserable. There, Biddy, unless I can lead a very different sort of life from the life I lead now."
"That's a pity," said Biddy, shaking her head with a sorrowful air.
Now I, too, had so often thought it a pity that in the singular kind of quarrel with myself which I was always carrying on, I was half inclined to shed tears of vexation and distress when Biddy gave utterance to her sentiment and my own. I told her she was right, and I knew it was much to be regretted, but still it was not to be helped. "If I could have settled down," I said to Biddy, plucking up the short grass within reach, much as I had once upon a time pulled my feelings out of my hair and kicked them into the brewery wall, "if I could have settled down and been but half as fond of the forge as I was when I was little, I know it would have been much better for me. You and I and Joe would have wanted nothing then, and Joe and I would perhaps have gone partners when I was out of my time, and I might even have grown up to keep company with you, and we might have sat on this very bank on a fine Sunday, quite different people. I should have been good enough for you, shouldn't I, Biddy?" Biddy sighed as she looked at the ship sailing on, and returned for answer,
"Yes,
I'm not over particular. It scarcely sounded flattering, but I knew she meant well.
Instead of that, said I, plucking up more grass and chewing a blade or two, see how I'm going on, dissatisfied and uncomfortable, and what would it signify to me, being coarse and common, if nobody had told me so?
Biddy turned her face suddenly towards mine, and looked far more attentively at me than she had looked at the sailing ships.
It was neither a very true nor a very polite thing to say, she remarked, directing her eyes to the ships again. Who said it?
I was disconcerted, for I had broken away without quite seeing where I was going to. It was not to be shuffled off now, however, and I answered, The beautiful young lady at Miss Havisham's, and she's more beautiful than anybody ever was, and I admire her dreadfully, and I want to be a gentleman on her account.
Having made this lunatic confession, I began to throw my torn-up grass into the river, as if I had some thoughts of following it.
Do you want to be a gentleman to spite her, or to gain her over?
Biddy quietly asked me, after a pause.
I don't know, I moodily answered. Because if it is to spite her, Biddy pursued, I should think, but you know best, that might be better and more independently done, by caring nothing for her words. And if it is to gain her over, I should think, but you know best, she was not worth gaining over.
Exactly what I myself had thought many times. Exactly what was perfectly manifest to me at the moment. But how could I, a poor dazed village lad, avoid that wonderful inconsistency into which the best and wisest of men fall every day?
It may be all quite true, said I to Biddy, but I admire her dreadfully.
In short, I turned over on my face when I came to that, and got a good grasp on the hair on each side of my head, and wrenched it well, all the while knowing the madness of my heart to be so very mad and misplaced that I was quite conscious it would have served my face right if I had lifted it up by my hair and knocked it against the pebbles as a punishment for belonging to such an idiot. Biddy was the wisest of girls, and she tried to reason no more with me. She put her hand, which was a comfortable hand, though roughened by work, upon my hands, one after another, and gently took them out of my hair. Then she softly patted my shoulder in a soothing way, while with my face upon her sleeve, I cried a little, exactly as I had done in the brewery yard, and felt vaguely convinced that I was very much ill-used by somebody or by everybody. I can't say which.
I'm glad of one thing, said Biddy, and that is that you have felt you could give me your confidence, Pip. And I'm glad of another thing, and that is that of course you know you may depend upon my keeping it, and always so far deserving it. If your first teacher, dear, such a poor one, and so much in need of being taught herself, had been your teacher at the present time, she thinks she knows what lesson she would set. But it would be a hard one to learn, and you have got beyond her, and it's of no use now.
So, with a quiet sigh for me, Biddy rose from the bank, and said, with a fresh and pleasant change of voice,
Shall we walk a little further, or go home?
Biddy, I cried, getting up, putting my arms around her neck, and giving her a kiss,
I shall always tell you everything. Till you're a gentleman, said Biddy. You know I never shall be, so that's always. Not that I have any occasion to tell you anything, for you know everything I know, as I told you at home the other night.
Ah, said Biddy, quiet in a whisper as she looked away at the ships, and then repeated with her former pleasant change,
Shall we walk a little further, or go home?
I said to Biddy, We would walk a little further, and we did so. And the summer afternoon toned down into the summer evening, and it was very beautiful. I began to consider whether I was not more naturally and wholesomely situated after all in these circumstances than playing beggar my neighbour by candlelight in the room with the stopped clocks and being despised by Estella. I thought it would be very good for me if I could get her out of my head with all the rest of those remembrances and fancies, and could go to work determined to relish what I had to do, and stick to it and make the best of it.
I asked myself the question, whether I did not surely know that if Estella were beside me at that moment instead of Biddy, she would make me miserable. I was obliged to admit that I did know it for a certainty, and I said to myself, "Pip, what a fool you are." We talked a good deal as we walked, and all that Biddy said seemed right. Biddy was never insulting or capricious, or Biddy today and somebody else tomorrow. She would have derived only pain and no pleasure from giving me pain. She would far rather have wounded her own breast than mine. How could it be, then, that I did not like her much the better of the two? "Biddy," said I when we were walking homeward, "I wish you could put me right."
"I wish I could," said Biddy.
"If I could only get myself to fall in love with you. You don't mind my speaking so openly to such an old acquaintance?"
"Oh, dear, not at all," said Biddy. "Don't mind me. If I could only get myself to do it, that would be the thing for me." "But you never will, you see," said Biddy.
It did not appear quite so unlikely to me that evening as it would have done if we had discussed it a few hours before. I therefore observed I was not quite sure of that. But Biddy said she was, and she said it decisively. In my heart, I believed her to be right, and yet I took it rather ill, too, that she could be so positive on the point. When we came near the churchyard, we had to cross an embankment and get over a stile near a sluice gate. There, started up from the gate or from the rushes or from the ooze, which was quite in his stagnant way, old Orlick.
"Hello," he growled. "Where are you two going?"
"Where should we be going but home?"
"Well, then," said he, "I'm jiggered if I don't see you home."
This penalty of being jiggered was a favourite superstitious case of his. He attached no definite meaning to the word that I am aware of, but used it, like his own pretended Christian name, to affront mankind and convey an idea of something savagely damaging. When I was younger, I'd had a general belief that if he had jiggered me personally, he would have done it with a sharp and twisted hook. Biddy was much against his going with us, and said to me in a whisper,
"Don't let him come. I don't like him."
As I did not like him either, I took the liberty of saying that we thanked him, but we didn't want seeing home. He received that piece of information with a yell of laughter, and dropped back, but came slouching after us at a little distance. Curious to know whether Biddy suspected him of having had a hand in that murderous attack of which my sister had never been able to give any account, I asked her why she didn't like him.
"Oh,"
she replied, glancing over her shoulder as he slouched after us,
"because I am afraid he likes me."
"Did he ever tell you he liked you?" I asked indignantly.
"No,"
said Biddy, glancing over her shoulder again. "He never told me so, but he dances at me whenever he can catch my eye." However novel and peculiar this testimony of attachment, I did not doubt the accuracy of the interpretation. I was very hot indeed upon old Orlick's daring to admire her, as hot as if it were an outrage on myself.
"But it makes no difference to you, you know," said Biddy calmly.
"No, Biddy, it makes no difference to me. Only I don't like it. I don't approve of it."
"Nor I neither," said Biddy, "though that makes no difference to you."
"Exactly," said I. "But I must tell you, I should have no opinion of you, Biddy, if he danced at you with your own consent." I kept an eye on Orlick after that night, and whenever circumstances were favourable to his dancing at Biddy, got before him to obscure that demonstration. He had struck root in Joe's establishment by reason of my sister's sudden fancy for him, or I should have tried to get him dismissed. He quite understood and reciprocated my good intentions, as I had reason to know thereafter. And now, because my mind was not confused enough before, I complicated its confusion 50,000-fold by having states and seasons when I was clear that Biddy was immeasurably better than Estella, and that the plain, honest working life to which I was born had nothing in it to be ashamed of, but
and offered me sufficient means of self-respect and happiness. At those times, I would decide conclusively that my disaffection to dear old Joe and the forge was gone, and that I was growing up in a